the homeless, our problem, for only one reason, that present raises the question, who owns the land? The homeless, our problem, for only one reason, our present raises the question, who owns the land? Who owns the land? Who owns the land? Who owns the land? Could it be 90 million dead Indians? Who owns the land? Could it be 6 million Jews? Who owns the land? Is there a connection? Who owns the land? To all imperialism? Who owns the land? Won't someone please tell me? Who owns the land? I am just a white man. Who owns the land? I live in the Americas. Who owns the land? How did I get here? This morning, I was awoken by a man with a handgun. He's got a book of rules that says I ain't got no right to sleep. This morning, I was awoken by a man with a handgun. He's got a book of rules that says I ain't got no right to be. Who owns the land? Who owns the land? Who owns the land? Could it be that there's a connection? Who owns the land? To my daily eviction. Who owns the land? And the extermination. Who owns the land? Of the Native American. Who owns the land? Won't someone please tell me? Who owns the land? 'Cause I am just a white man. Who owns the land? I live in the Americas. Who owns the land? How did I get here? Owns its own self. Maybe it's the Native America. The homeless are a problem for only one reason. My present raises a question, who owns the land? The homeless are a problem for only one reason. Your presence raises the question, who owns the land? Ecocide, genocide, where is home? Ecocide, genocide, where is home? Ecocide, genocide, where is home? Ecocide, genocide, where is home?
Welcome to another edition of Bathrobs Piers Broadsides. It's, wow, February 13th. No, we're beyond the 13th. We're on the 19th, the 18th, the 20th. Where am I? Anyway, we're we're in the studio in front of the mic after a week away. I got to orient myself date-wise. I guess the 16th was Sunday, so we're 17th, 18th, 19th. Gosh, the 20th already. Missed the long Sunday show, and I apologize for that, but I was up in San Francisco doing the 200,000-person march, 200,000 to 300,000 people against the war, and we've got some tape on that. We're going to be playing that today here on the air, particularly the alternate march, the breakaway march, much lambasted in the press, but of some interest to me, because these were people who wanted to essentially stop business as usual. And, of course, the very presence of 200,000 to 300,000 people, or 150,000, as the mainstream media said, depending on what you want to believe, does, in fact, stop business as usual. But there's an increasing awareness that simply showing up for protests doesn't seem to have much impact on Führer Bush and his inner circle of advisors. Hence, more creative ways of stopping the wheels of war seems to be in order, and that is what I guess is being experimented with in these alternative marches. And you're going to hear a little bit of my covering the marches. It's a pretty raw footage, and it's not as polished, for example, as some other broadcasters who do great work. For example, we're also going to hear the V-Man did some great work with the town hall meeting, which happened on Tuesday night here in Santa Cruz at the Del Mar Theater. And that was the O'Reilly Farr City Council. We let you talk for 2 minutes and then sit you down, and then Farr gave a kind of a 20-minute answer to all the various questions. It was all sort of a question-answer period with Farr. But it did give people in the audience a chance to express on occasion some of their anger when they could get over thanking the city council for their wonderful patience and goodwill in setting up a town hall meeting 3 months after it was initially requested by members of the community. And as I've mentioned in numerous writings, we would be well into the war had it not been for the fact that there have been massive protests by all of us and significant resistance from the governments of Russia, France, Germany, and China that is slowing down the juggernaut in Washington. Certainly not stopping it, but slowing it down. Anyway, the V-Man did great work at doing a collage of this. I don't have a recording of the collage, but you can actually hear that collage by going to the internet to www.santacruz.indymedia, I-N-D-Y-M-E-D-I-A, indymedia, a lot of good stuff there, .org, and you kind of scroll down the right side of the screen and you'll see the V-Man's video collage, as well as a better version of what I'm going to play you now, which is Representative Farr's final response to all of the questions. Most of the questions were hostile questions toward Bush. Everybody kind of agrees that Bush is the bad boy. There's no dispute there. The question is, what is the city government and the state and federal government representatives locally, what are they doing that can actually have a significant impact? And the answer is that they're doing very little. And that's the problem, and they have been doing very little. And the answer is, how do we make them responsible? What's the answer to that? I don't know, that question was not raised so much. There were a few people. Celia Scott raised the issue, saying to Representative Farr, you've got to do more. In fact, a number of us went to Farr's office 3 times in the fall asking for simple answers to questions like, will you now come out against depleted uranium weapons? Will you now sponsor a second resolution stopping the use of force in Iraq? Will you now switch your vote on the military appropriation, or at least apologize to the Santa Cruz community for that vote on the same day you voted against the force resolution in Iraq? Will you hold a town hall meeting? We asked a number of questions, and some of those, you know, Farr has responded, albeit very slowly, to a few of those, but to some of the key questions he has not responded, or he's giving kind of fudgy responses to the issue of the uranium-depleted weapons, those horrible weapons that last for tens of thousands of years, maybe longer, I'm not entirely sure. They go through tanks like butter, but then they lay around and kill people afterward. Civilians, military, babies, old people, you name it. They're there. They're radioactive debris, and they also cause, of course, damage to the soldiers who've used them. And there's been all kinds of after effects of the Iraqi First War, which have not been addressed by the U.S. military 13 years later. So his answer was something to the effect of, oh, I'm very concerned about that, and I'm trying to fund a study to build a majority. That was kind of what he said. That's not enough for me. He has to simply back a resolution that says no use of uranium-depleted weapons, period. And until he can say that and starts, instead of talking about funding studies and maybe somewhere down the road building a majority, he's not taking a position on the issue. He didn't take a position when Clinton was using them in Yugoslavia, and he's still not taking a position. I brought this up again, on that same website, www.santacruz.indymedia.org, and there's kind of a debate going on there. Although, I think most people agree with me on this one. The problem is they don't bring it to his attention strongly enough so he is able to fudge the issue, and he's more interested in pleasing, I guess, a military constituency or possibly other large donors who don't want to upset the military or have some kind of interest in maintaining this uranium-depleted weapons support. I don't know, but that question remains unanswered. I left messages with his office today asking for a specific answer to the question, will he introduce immediately a resolution against uranium-depleted weapons? Will he introduce a resolution demanding the end of the economic sanctions in Iraq, which have killed hundreds of thousands of children and several million people over the last decade, as I understand it, from UN figures? And so far he's done nothing about that. He talked about that, too. Again, he gave a kind of a fudgerama answer, and I'll play a little bit of what he said generally. I think it isn't worth spending a lot of time on, and it is available on the Internet if you want to listen to it. But here is Farr kind of responding to the angry, and mostly just angry at Bush commentary, which I think is unfortunate, because we need to get angry at the local officials who aren't doing anything and stop praising them for holding these pro forma, too little, too late town hall meetings. So let's fire up the tape here. Here's Representative Farr at the Del Mar.
I think, Mrs. Brown, you brought it all home to us when you talked about your experience in Syria. And I think we have to look at this perspective. And I hope that as we go forth, not only here tonight, but in the community, what I would urge is that we really start focusing on the way one gets democracy to work, and that is that we still in a country of the rule of majority, and when that majority is something that you don't like, you can get mad at it, but the best way to do it is to try to through a process of petitioning your government. Squeaky wheels do get the grease. Congress is made up of 435 individuals, the House of Representatives. Just like people in this room, from all walks of life, they represent the same number of people, 650,000 people. What you don't see is that there is one opinion across America that represents this, and I think tonight's discussion brought out the various views and the various priorities that people put on those views. But what does work is the ability to make their districts, I think, more sensitive to the fact that you can't go to Washington and vote on a foreign policy without knowing the consequences of that policy here at home. And what was so impressive tonight is not only the city council and the action they took to be the first in the country, and a council that representing a small city, which is the majority of cities in America that followed suit. And as Emily said, there's, 90 cities. So that is what one can do is what you did here to petition this city council to take its action, followed suit. I'm getting to that. The other thing that I think is very important is that the teachers from Aptos tonight, there's a National Teachers Association movement. The teachers in these school districts around the country, if they take action such as this and communicate it with the members of the House of Representatives, you'll begin to see a change. And where does that change come home? It's this proposed war in Iraq. This is a very, very expensive proposal. The last time we were in the Middle East in 1991, the cost of that war was about $56 billion. Payment for that was borne by all the countries that participated. The United States picked up about $6 billion of the $56 billion. This war, we're going at it alone. That amount of money is the kind of money that, you know, we could be using to solve health care problems. We could be used to solve educational needs in this country. And we could be using to devise alternative fuels and certainly a a vehicle which would get more mileage. There are several things, all these issues raise different points. One of the things that we have debated long in this country is the energy policy. It just so happens that this administration is very hooked on oil. They want to drill for more oil in Anwar. We're radically opposing that in Congress, trying to block. We're going to try to see if we can block it on the House floor. Don't know if we have the votes. We argued strongly to try to improve the CAFE standards so that Detroit would have to build cars that would got higher mileage. We're all kind of guilty of that because as consumers of automobiles, we go out and still buy what's on the market, which is the low the SUV vehicle, which is exempt from these standards. So the energy policy in America to be changed has got to be changed by a consumer movement, by not only talking about it, but shopping about it, and by for asking governments to buy cars and use fuel-efficient equipment, school districts, and so on. Why does that count? Because governments, frankly, in the end, are one of the largest buyers of consumer goods. The cars that law enforcement uses, that the fire departments use, that the public works uses, that school buses use, I mean, on and on. You can see where where public governments as a have a big role in it. And little by little, you start changing that policy, and then it changes in Washington. We're not the first to react in Washington. We're usually the last, because this nation does not start as a progressive nation. It starts as a nation of the people that are in the majority. The impeachment process was brought up tonight. That impeachment process, as you know from your studies, begins in the House Judiciary Committee with a hearing of that committee. And
okay, well, let's interrupt this somewhat self-serving series of comments on questions that were put to him. We've been listening to Representative Sam Farr. Here, let me play a couple more sentences and then comment.
The Republican-controlled committee, it did have hearings on President Clinton because they controlled the committee, passed articles of impeachment out of the committee into the House floor, which was also controlled by the Republican majority, which brought it to a vote. I don't see that the hearings or even they have an interest in beginning any hearings in that committee. And without that process, you cannot have an impeachment process in a law.
So the point here is for Sam, he's saying that, well, it's the sort of the thing here at the Santa Cruz City Council. I don't have the votes, so I won't take the leadership to demand impeachment. He can, as Henry Waxman did back in 1990, demand impeachment even if he is alone. He can demand impeachment. He can vote with Barbara Lee even if he's only in a small minority against the military budget, but he declined to do so. He can vote against sanctions that have been killing people in Iraq, even if he doesn't have all his duckies lined up, and he can speak out about it. He can do the same thing with uranium-depleted weapons rather than talk about, let's get us some money together for a study, which is what he said later on. And he doesn't. So it's important for people to listen carefully to what he's saying. It seems that I think the force of public opinion is having some impact on him, but not much. I mean, not a great deal. Certainly not enough. In the studio with me is the indisputable, or perhaps very disputatious, Jeffrey Gale. Hey, Jeffrey.
Hey. Good evening. It's a beautiful evening in the neighborhood.
Yeah, now you were kind of involved in this whole town hall stuff, and you walked all the way from the east side to come to the radio station tonight. What do you got to tell us?
Well, basically, Robert, I feel that after monitoring the Jim Lehrer NewsHour, which comes on live from 3 to 4 here in Santa Cruz today, I'm thoroughly convinced that just having anti-war rallies and town hall meetings will not prevent the United States of America and its allies, some allies, from using military force. So I come from the place that people need to do the following. A, you have to really be willing to call for a nationwide general strike. It has to be well organized, as Reverend James Lawson said. In other words, a day when no one in the United States will go to work and no one will teach school. That will, in my opinion, send a very strong message to this president, who's illegal, to his entire government, which in my opinion is illegal, to say, hey, we are not going to allow you folks to go to war with our money. Point B, everyone is running to Henry Block, getting their taxes ready for April 15th. Bottom line, gotta put your body on the line and tell the United States government that you won't pay one single penny to the Internal Revenue Service this April 15th before midnight unless the government understands that they cannot fire one shot in the Middle East or the Near East. I've also come to the conclusion, Robert, that if the United States of America fires one shot, really goes in and makes war, I believe there will be immediate retaliatory measures against the United States. Today, several people were arrested in the United States, a couple of college professors from the University of South Florida. There's no doubt in my mind that this is the Bertrand Russell maniac theory. This is insanity if the United States of America thinks that it can use military force against Iran, Iraq, North Korea, and not think that immediately, that very day, we will get smashed and smashed hard, much harder than we did on September the 11th. It was shown today that the arrests that were made were very, very intelligent people right here in the United States, in Florida, people in this country who had passports from London, from England. And so it is idiotic to think that if we have an anti-war rally every single day and a town hall meeting every single day, that those two things alone will stop this illegal government. And I'm going to repeat, it's an illegal government. We have the former United States Senator Mosley Braun from my home state of Illinois. She announced she's running for president of the United States, and she went right on with Judy Woodruff on CNN today and said that there is no way in the world that anyone will be elected president of the United States if they are in favor of going to war against Iraq. She's now in the race. Dennis Kucinich is in the race. And bottom line, when I interviewed Sam Farr personally after the town hall meeting, he actually said to me that if Dennis Kucinich gets the nomination of the Democratic Party and runs with Barbara Lee of Berkeley on the ticket, Sam went on the record as saying he will vote for that ticket. So I think it is encouraging that Kucinich is in this. I believe that Kucinich is a brother hand-in-hand with Ralph Nader. Dennis Kucinich is against the war in Iraq. He's against the death penalty at all times. He's for single-payer health insurance. And so, bottom line, I now feel, Robert, that Ralph Nader will not run for president of the United States because Dennis is in the race, and they're very, very, they're like brothers. They talk to each other every week.
That's
bottom line, Vice President Gore did not run again because he couldn't get the funding to run, and it's clear to me that anyone who studied Vice President Gore's record during his 8 years as vice president, he was militant, super militant. Never did he criticize President Clinton, who in my opinion is a terrorist at this moment. I believe that George W. Bush is a terrorist, as big a terrorist as Saddam Hussein. And the bottom line is, we just had a story in the last 24 hours that some student actually wore a T-shirt that said that President George W. Bush is a terrorist, and he was banned from his high school. I believe that was today or yesterday.
I'm actually wearing that T-shirt for all of you who see me on the streets. It has a picture of George. It's headed international terrorist. And by the way, I apologize if my mic wasn't up there. He has some trouble hearing. It's not because you're going deaf. It's because you're dealing with someone whose competence is, shall we say, he's microphone challenged here at Free Radio Santa Cruz. 96.3 FM is what you're listening to. I'm Robert Norris. I've got Jeffrey Gale with me. Phone number is 427-3772 in case you want to call in and join the discussion. I would like kind of, again, to focus on what's happening in Santa Cruz. A lot of things happened this weekend in terms of the biggest protest in Santa Cruz since, I guess, the Rodney King protest, maybe even bigger, in 1992, and the first Iraqi War protest when the freeways were occupied by several thousand people who took the freeways to protest. I guess it was the air war against Iraq in either, I think it was January of 1991. And there was a similar response. Freeways were again taken in 92 after the Simi Valley acquittal of the cops who beat up Rodney King. What we've had so far is of course, a very massive protest on Saturday, and I've actually got some tape from that. I think what I'm going to play now, after you've said your piece, Jeffrey, you may have a few more things you want to say at this point, is play something from the alternate rally up in San Francisco, which happened the next day on Sunday. There was, of course, a huge rally where people walked from the Embarcadero down to Civic Center Plaza, bigger, much bigger than before, if that could be, if that was, and that was possible, that did happen. And then there was a larger rally that, I should say a smaller rally, but larger than the previous alternate rally, which did a similar thing in January a month ago, and kind of walked around town. Look, I think there was a plan to snarl business in the downtown area with sit-downs, in the shops and in the downtown shopping areas, but that was apparently blocked by police. Instead, it was kind of routed back onto Market Street. So I think I'm going to play some of that. Unless you want to say something, Jeffrey?
Yeah, the disgusting thing to me about that peace march in San Francisco last Sunday were the people who were running the peace march made an agreement with the San Francisco Police Department that because of the Chinatown New Year's parade, they would push the peace march up to the next day because 1 million people normally attend the Chinatown New Year's parade, and this year, because of heavy rain, only 500,000 showed up. But what was so disgusting to me, Robert, was how KGO, Eyewitness News, ABC Television, when there some of the so-called peaceniks, who weren't peaceniks at all, who came there with the intention to, in my opinion, be violent and get arrested, just like the Raider Nation, the KGO Eyewitness News, they led with that. If it bleeds, it leads. They made it appear to the public on the 11 o'clock news that night that this was an extremely violent march and that it's a dangerous thing to go to these anti-war rallies. And, of course, people in the White House played that up. Republicans played it up. Here in Santa Cruz, we had a very peaceful demonstration. It was well attended. Some people said there were as many as 7,500 here. And the bottom line is that the media continues to have bullshit, like 43 million people watching Joe the Millionaire, the San Jose Mercury News refusing to put one sentence on the front page of the fifth biggest daily newspaper in the United States about the whole situation in the Near East, in the Middle East, just the day before yesterday. It's outrageous, and I again want everyone listening to this show to call the editors of the San Jose Mercury News. Boycott the Mercury News. Cancel your subscriptions immediately.
And you're... Hang on, please. Hello? Oops. We have a problem here. Sorry about that, caller. Let's try again. Let's see here. Looks like we have a technical phone problem. We're getting a hum on the phone when we try to get our incoming calls. I don't know what the answer to that one is. If any technical wizards are running around out there and want to come in and help us in the studio, please do come. It looks like the phone line may be down for broadcast. Could be something. We'll try.
hit me when I pulled up to gas up my car that they're going to try and force us into a war one way or another. The gas prices changed almost overnight, you know, and are all up around $2 a gallon. So I really resent. I think that the administration thinks of us like cattle and as so low that if things like this happen, if the oil companies raise their prices, that we can be turned into murderers. That because we don't want to pay $2 a gallon, that they can turn us into people who will support murder. And they can't. And one of the good things about this war effort, one of the very good things is that the people right now who are protesting remember Vietnam. They remember it very well. When Vietnam happened, people like my parents felt all wars were just. We did not have their support. We had some older people support, but not very many. All wars were good wars. We were always defending ourselves, and now we know better. This capitalistic stuff has just got to stop. I'm glad that there are T-shirts that say Bush is a terrorist. That's exactly what he is. I don't know who made us the keeper of the free world, where we can tell who can be armed and who cannot. And we've sold them many of our arms, our old arms, as we come up with new stuff. So we're actually, in a lot of ways, to blame for people, for other countries being armed.
Oh, definitely.
I could go on forever, but I...
What about locally, Roxanne? I know you've been a pungent critic of the city council, and I'm sure probably of the county planning department, as being unresponsive to the needs of local citizens. How can we react locally that might have some impact on the war? How can we support?
Well, I think that Jeffrey's suggestions are right on target. I really don't think that marching... I really think there's a news blackout on almost everything. There's so little on the anti-war effort. There's something but very little all the time, and it never reflects the huge numbers that people turned out in. So I really think that, I mean, I'm serious. I really think that the capitalistic system, what Jeffrey is saying, where you don't pay your taxes, where you don't go to work, where the schools don't get money, where, you know, I really think that it's going to have to happen before anybody's going to listen. I don't think that just holding up signs, and I don't want to negate the anti-war sentiment because it's very important, but I think we're at a point where there's some kind of action, and I like what he's suggesting because it doesn't involve blood, because a lot of people feel like this is the time for a revolution. This is it. And, of course, you know, that just means more bloodshed. So that, you know, it means Kent State magnified or Tiananmen Square. I think that this is much more powerful. I think money talks in our country. I really do. Also, retaliation-wise, I think that people who are smart recognize that this is not something that's just going to happen overseas. That as soon as we hit them, that it's going to happen on every front. It's going to happen in America. There's going to be, you can call it terrorism, you can call it defending yourself, whatever you want, but a lot of people don't want to bow to that. They say, well, then that's terrorism. I don't want to not go to war. That proves Bush's point, that we have to be afraid of them. Well, I think if you push anybody into a corner, you need to be afraid of them. It's just common sense. And so I really think that the casualties in America itself are going to be quite great. And I don't think they're going to be pleasant. I think they're going to be excruciating. I think they are going to involve chemicals.
Well, that's going to, you know, unfortunately, that'll set up the garrison state for the people that want to, you know, push, Ridge and Bush and Negroponte and...
But I think that we're totally expendable. I think to our country we are totally expendable. You know, during the Second World War, people were all issued gas masks in England, and, you know, people had a place to go. They had a plan, you know. Talking about duct taping a room shut, I don't think so. I mean, we are really expendable. The troops are expendable to him. Everyone is really expendable.
Well, it's outrageous because in England, you know, the country was being invaded by the Nazis. That's, you know, if the Iraqis had expeditionary forces and they were about to arrive, we wouldn't be having these shows.
No.
We'd be defending ourselves. But
no.
The fact of the matter is, you've got exactly the opposite going on and this complete inversion in the media. So any ideas about, you think, any specific ideas about local actions? I know people have talked about occupying military centers, about occupying Farr's office, about kind of Earth First type things, sleepouts, tent cities.
Well, I think that probably you're more experienced in that than I am, Robert. Robert, because I've always been raising children, I've always been very careful not to be arrested, not to have my children taken away.
Well, remember, if you start chalking on the street, you could be taken away immediately.
But I haven't taken part in a lot of the things that are definitely more gutsy. I stop where it looks like the police could move in because political activists lose their children very easily, and that is one thing that I was never willing to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that maybe you should, I'll get off the phone. There's probably people who really do know better than I what to do.
Well, I think you can also engage in support for protesters, and I don't mean violent protest. I mean strong, direct action, nonviolent protest.
You can get arrested for going to a city council meeting. I don't go there anymore because I didn't want to lose my kid if I were put in jail and have CPS move in. So I'm just saying that, you know, it's the city council actually, I mean, I'm sorry, but they mimic exactly the George Bush thing. I don't care what Scott Kennedy does in his free time with his free money pretending to be Gandhi. The proof is in the pudding. So they are just mirroring the kind of Nazism that is prevalent in this country right now.
It's true that they are cracking down on political protest, passing more repressive laws, eliminating police oversight, and things of that sort, no question about it. Thank you for calling in, Roxanne.
Okay, thanks, Robert. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And our lines are open, 427-3772. We're going to kind of swing into a little tape here, but if you call in, we'll put you on if you want to talk about this issue or about other issues. If you have announcements about upcoming protests or meetings around resisting the war or resisting the downtown ordinances, which went into effect the most latest version on February 13th, it's now illegal to have a political table anywhere downtown for more than an hour, and you can only have that table if you are 10 feet away from a building, a bench, a drinking fountain, a kiosk, a crosswalk. That is to say, most of the sidewalk is now forbidden as far as having any kind of so-called display device if you are a political tabler. Ironically, this law, which was supposed to regulate the great musician menace, exempts musicians largely. Open guitar cases are not really considered display devices under the law, at least according to the wording of the law, in spite of confused testimony to the opposite at city council. And there is a specific spare-changing exemption for musicians, but not for people seeking to get donations for political literature or political causes, or just begging because they need the money for food. Under those circumstances, there are very strict regulations about asking for money. You can't do it from a seated position. You can't do it after dark. You can't do it in a group of two. You can't do it within 14 feet, not just 10 feet, but 14 feet of a building, 14 feet of a kiosk. Essentially, 95% of the sidewalk is ruled out under the new anti-homeless Riley-Kennedy downtown ordinances. Riley is our mayor. Kennedy is our vice mayor. So that's our local situation, and it's kind of peculiar to hear Riley denouncing the Patriot Act, perhaps not that peculiar, or the city council kind of doing a symbolic vote against the Patriot Act, the national repressive legislation, but supporting anti-homeless laws locally. Of course, that has been the case for the last decade with virtually every city council. I think the only exception was Celia Scott, and unfortunately you don't hear her leading the protests against these actions. She kind of gave it up once she left power, and even when she was in power, she was not a particularly strong voice in that regard, although she did vote against it when these laws came up, and she spoke against it somewhat as well. There is going to be something coming up around this issue. I've mentioned before that I'm doing a federal lawsuit against Sergeant Lauren Baker, Merchant Matisse Matthew Selman of Sushi Now, the City of Santa Cruz, Chief Steve Belcher, the head of the police department, for a false arrest that happened a year ago in January outside of New Leaf Market, and I was arrested for tabling. Having a political table, I was asking for a boycott of Sushi Now, Alibaba's Cafe, now Cafe Campesino, and New Leaf Market, because these businesses, colluded in privatizing a vast part of the sidewalk there in order to drive away young people and drive away alternate people and drive away the grubby crowd, as some of them called it. And they did this without any meaningful public process. They did this without considering real alternatives. And it is in the same kind of spirit that they've walled off with laws 95% of the sidewalk for political tablers. And that followed 4 or 5 months later last summer and went into effect, as I said, on February 13th of this year. So anyway, I didn't have the money to go to a lawyer to get this done, but lawyers came to me and they said, hey, sue them and we will take the case. And I said, fine, because we're not going to get too much out of this financially, perhaps, or maybe we will, it's hard to say, that we may be able to stop them from proceeding if we can get a federal court to rule you can't just remove political tablers because the police and merchants decide they don't like what you're doing. And then they opportunistically use a law like blocking the sidewalk. All charges against me, by the way, were dismissed on this issue. They concocted a new charge of being in a forbidden zone, which they also dropped because I wasn't in a forbidden zone. The original charge of blocking the sidewalk was illegal before it started because the very act of blocking the sidewalk, the law they used, it was not blocking the sidewalk if you were engaged in political activity, and that's, you can see that by reading two sentences down in the law. The fact that the city attorney or Sergeant Baker, who issued this ticket, chose not to read that, and Commissioner Joseph, who oversaw hearing after hearing on this issue and allowed the case to go on and on and on, finally only dismissing it when everybody didn't show up except me, shows me that there is not only bad police department, bad city attorney's office, bad collusion between merchants and the police, but also a judicial system that is colluding in a kind of profound corruption. Now, you might say, well, you know, here's this Robert Norse guy, that's me, you know, this cranky activist, he's always, you know, screaming about something. You know, I'm actually kind of talking about the same things. I have been talking about the same things for about a decade and a half, and that is laws that criminalize poor people. I don't think they're right. I think we have to resist them. I think they will eventually come back and bite the rest of us in the butt, even those of us who think that we are safe in our homes or if we have rented rooms. But this is all just a very bad tendency that's going on, and we have to fight it. So anyway, next Wednesday at 12:30, high noon plus 30 minutes, in front of Sushi Now, we are going to hold a press conference announcing specifically, it'll have been done by this time, the lawsuit will have been filed and the appropriate parties served for federal lawsuit, the whole issue of this lawsuit, what it's about, the significance it has. We'll have people speaking from the Green Party, people speaking from organizations concerned about selective enforcement and the closing of the Citizens Police Review Board that is now dead, thanks to Emily Riley, Ed Porter, Mark Premack, Scott Kennedy, and all the rest of these progressive clowns. I guess Premack wouldn't call himself a progressive, but the rest of this gang, Fitzmaurice, et cetera, would, and of course Rotkin and Matthews. We'll be talking about that, and you can come on down, 12:30, and see what's cooking with this. Such a suit in federal court takes a while. You have to follow it through. It may take a couple of years even to get anywhere, or it may go more quickly. I've also have on appeal a lawsuit against the city council, again, taken by attorneys that I couldn't afford to hire, but they came forward and said, hey, let's do it. This is such a constitutional violation. We got to stop it. That's when the police arrested me on a demand by Mayor Crone because I raised my arm in a you're acting like a bunch of fascists Nazi salute to the council after they shut up peace activist Susan Zeman, who tried to go to the mic and was cut off by Mayor Crone, even though the time hadn't ended. And all I did was I made a fleeting silent gesture, and I was arrested, taken to jail, held for 5 hours. And that's under your the great liberal Chris Crone, who, by the way, has never apologized for that behavior yet. And I know I don't really blame him, actually. I think it was Fitzmaurice, because Fitzmaurice was the one who wanted me arrested, and he's the brains or the brawn behind the operation. But the mayor has a responsibility not to do that. And this case is being appealed. It was originally thrown out in an unexpected summary dismissal, which means they dismissed it without hearing the evidence in a strange kind of dismissal. We pulled the wrong judge, actually, is what it boiled down to. and we just got a strange decision. And we're going to see if at a higher court they will actually consider it. And that should be coming up in a couple of months. It's being briefed. And you don't read about it in the papers because the Sentinel and the Mercury News are not interested in covering it. Jeffrey?
And Robert, I wanted to tell our listeners tonight that on the front page of the Los Angeles Times National Edition yesterday, there was a huge photograph of an 81-year-old man who appeared in front of the Los Angeles City Council dealing with protesting the fact that the United States is possibly about to go to war against Iraq. And at that city council meeting, each person, like here in Santa Cruz, got just, say, 2 minutes to speak. And because he spoke just beyond 2 minutes, the police ushered him out of the meeting. And the Los Angeles Times, in their national edition, this went all over the world, of this 81-year-old man being escorted out of the city council meeting. I mean, that reminded me of our old brother Jerry Rubin and all his battles on the Third Street Promenade in Santa Monica to be able to have his table and pass out literature. And of course, when Jerry attempted to run for city council a year or so ago, you have to fill out a form as to what your occupation is. And Jerry put on the form that he was a peace activist. And they said, Mr. Rubin, you cannot run for city council in Santa Monica and state that your occupation is peace activist. Of course, Jerry had a good lawyer go to court for him, and he won. And on the ballot, it did say Jerry Rubin, comma, peace activist. That's not the Jerry Rubin that was killed jaywalking years ago from the Chicago 8 conspiracy trial.
Yeah, I think one of the activists locally, I think Thomas Levitt, who ran for city council this last fall, tried to put activist on his ballot. I could be wrong. It could be someone else I'm thinking of. And they refused to let it on. Maybe either they hadn't heard of the Rubin decision, they were ignoring it, or perhaps it hadn't come out yet.
It made there was a major photograph in USA Today with Jerry Rubin when he won that lawsuit. In other words, it wasn't, it dealt with the application you have to file when you run for office. They said he couldn't put down that he was a peace activist, and the fact that he won the lawsuit meant that when the ballot came out, it had to say Jerry Rubin, comma, peace activist.
So keep that in mind, all you folks who want to waste your time running for these local and national elections. Maybe not waste your time. I think it can be, you know, a platform. It can mean something, and I'm glad that Steve Argue and Thomas Levitt stood up and spoke out about these issues last fall. I'm glad that David Silva did it in the past. I'm glad that Linda LeMaster has done it in the past. Linda Edwards, Brian Koepke, other homeless activists who've tried to do it. Realistically speaking, however, the illusion of democracy is important, not to buy the bullshit. I mean, you have to see what actually has some effect on the community and the political process, and recognize what is actually just a way of buying into business as usual. And unfortunately, the current, for example, city council has nothing to do with progressive principles in areas like rent control, civil rights for homeless people, oversight of the police, control of the university, creation of affordable housing, stopping racial profiling locally. They are not interested in these issues. And as far as the CPRB in exile goes, kind of a little update, that's the proposal by former CPRB, well, he's the chair of the former CPRB, which was destroyed by the the Riley Kennedy Council. That they were going to meet, I believe, they were trying to meet in the middle of this week, but they didn't. Mark is struggling to do a number of things at the same time as even tonight. I believe he's working on a show, Voices, starting at 7:30 on community TV. Sarah Phelan is asking questions of experts on immigration, and if you want to tune into that at 7:30, that's on, Channel 27, the cable TV channel, the community television station, which didn't cover our town hall piece, Cry for Peace, the attempt to have a dialogue with Representative Sam Farr. And again, if you want more information, if you want to hear the far side, so to speak, and hear our side, hear both sides, go to www.santacruz.indymedia.org, and you can actually hear an audio of a kind of a collage of what some of the people said, and you can also hear Farr's complete non-response, or his response. I mean, this sort of makes me pretty ill to hear it. I guess Jeffrey is pointing to this article in this week's Metro called Net Loss by Sarah Phelan, which he has a lot more regard for than I do. It's about social services and the loss of social services locally and the social service needs. Jeffrey, you want to talk about that?
Well, I think it's to the credit of Metro Santa Cruz that they did have this cover story, and Sarah Phelan wrote it. And, of course, Robert, when you and I talked last night, you were wondering whether she put any actual figures in her piece about how many people are actually homeless, and she did write that meanwhile demand for all of these programs continues to rise as Santa Cruz County's safety net strains at the seams. Paul Brindell, program director of the Community Action Board's shelter project, estimates that about 10,000 people were homeless at some point last year in Santa Cruz County, with 3,500 permanently unhoused. So I do give the publisher of this publication credit and the journalist who wrote this, but I agree with you, Robert, that it's just kind of something that they do once a year and that's it. Meantime, the Good Times cover story that came out today is disgusting, travels on the fringe,
before you leave,
blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
When the nation's about to go to war, the publisher of the Good Times is telling everyone, oh, gee, let's do some luxury camping down in Big Sur.
Next week they'll do do-si-do and change positions. The Good Times and Metro Santa Cruz are fundamentally identical. The Good Times did some good stuff, for example, briefly on Amy Courtney and Cassandra Brown's effective court suit against Caltrans. You will allow flags up on the overpasses, but and you put up any peace signs and we'll kick your ass and tear them down. You know, they did a pretty good coverage on that in a couple of other articles. I mean, you occasionally get the occasional good article in either the Good Times or the Metro. This, in my mind, is not a good article. Sarah Phelan knows a hell of a lot more about this issue than she's reporting, and particularly important, those figures aren't even accurate. Brindell claiming that there is 3,500 permanently homeless, it's actually more like we estimate 6,000 to 10,000 in the county and 1,000 to 2,000 in the city. I mean, that's he vastly undercounts. That's point one. And
that's as many people, Robert, as marched in the peace march here in Santa Cruz. The estimate was 7,500. So I agree. All of these numbers are under.
But
in Chicago, the National Coalition for the Homeless said there are only 1 million homeless people.
Right. It's not the numbers, Jeffrey.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
the fact that there is no indication of the failure of the social services to address the shelter issue. You don't find in that story or in anything ever written by Dan White of the Sentinel or Ken McLaughlin of the Mercury News, and they've been the kind of the key lead reporters in those two dailies for the last 2 years, so that indicates the fact that 90%, 95% of homeless people in the summer and about 80% in the winter have no choice but to sleep illegally outside in tents or in vehicles where they face $54 tickets, wake-ups, vehicle seizures, harassment, midnight searches, and the kind of Patriot Act stuff that these same officials who are giving us these laws profess such horror for nationally. You don't have any of that kind of coverage. I've asked Phelan endlessly to do a story on the sleeping ban. She's declined. You know, I mean, she does endless puff pieces. If you look at most of Phelan's stuff, it's puff piece shit. I'm sorry, Sarah. You know, I mean, she does do this news section, which, you know, he has a little story on the peace movement, a little story on Farr, and she did a little kind of critique of the city council's killing the Citizens Police Review Board. You know, that's good, and I'm good to find the occasional good piece, but generally speaking, the reporting is horrible on these issues. And Bruce Bratton, of course, who's given an entire page. Why do they waste an entire page on Bruce Bratton? I just don't understand. You know, we get to read about his opinions of movies, and I guess the best thing about his column is you get to see old photos of how Santa Cruz used to look, which I kind of like. But the rest of his shit, anyway, I could rant on.
Weekly newspapers, magazines on newsprint have really come down to being lifestyle newspapers. I wrote for the Pacific Sun and Marin County way back in the middle 70s, and we won national journalism awards for really doing stuff about penal reform and all kinds of stuff like that. Now, pick up the San Francisco Weekly, pick up the East Bay Express, pick up the Pacific Sun, pick up the Good Times. These are what we call lifestyle publications. I think it's disgusting that KSCO Radio, they were going to do this town hall meeting live. Rosemary Chalmers tried her best to convince the owner, and the owner, of course, said, unless we can get one particular human being to sponsor it, we will not cover it. Bottom line, it wasn't covered. Same thing happened with televising the town hall meeting in Santa Cruz. You know, it was money. You know, to me, it's ridiculous to put on a town hall meeting when the mayor and the city council don't first make sure it's going to be televised and on the radio. That's the job of the mayor and the city council and the board of supervisors to get this done. It's ridiculous.
Okay, well, the problem is that they're not interested in substantial changes here or in really rocking the boat. They're interested in, you know, this is a form of symbolism. I mean, there's a little more towards substance because of the incredible crisis, which I think is freaking out Riley and others as well. I mean, I want to give her the credit that I did see her out there trying to make sure everybody got into the meeting, giving out little tickets and so forth, although she cut back people's speaking time. Again, she told us we're all, I got informed by a city clerk, Leslie Cook, 2 days in advance, you will have 5 minutes to speak as an organization, as a member of HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the group I am with. So I sat down, I wrote a 7-minute speech with five of it ready to give. Got there, it was 3 minutes. She's done this repeatedly at city council meetings, even in violation of basic custom, which is that at city council meetings where they're changing laws, they're required to give 5 minutes of time to speakers at the public hearings, and she doesn't. Crone did the same thing. They are more interested in giving their city council time to babble on and on and on than they are to give the public an opportunity, A, to express their opinion, and B, what they should really do, of course, is allow the public to get into meaningful dialogue with the city council. That would happen through, for example, having a second period of speaking time, which would be shorter, maybe for a minute each, where the public could come up and make comments and ask questions after the staff, which is given a huge amount of time at city council meetings, is allowed to speak. And the staff, it's the staff proposal that usually 95% of the time rams its way through the council, and it's what they accept. And unfortunately, it's from this conservative milieu, these conservative shadowy figures who are not elected by anybody. Dick Wilson, Steve Belcher of the police department, Dick Wilson, the city manager, the head of Parks and Rec, the head of the redevelopment agency. All these folks are the people who have the real power, who make the real choices, and they make it in private. It's just like, and it's interesting, their process of proceeding in back rooms has infected the city council so that now Riley and Porter hold ad hoc meetings where if you try to record what goes on, like I did on November 4th, you get arrested. You get dragged out of the meeting and arrested. I was arrested for misdemeanor. You know, of course, they couldn't take it to court because no jury would convict me of tape recording a city council subcommittee meeting, but they, you know, they intimidate those who might do it. They probably intimidate me, too. I mean, I have to think, okay, can I afford to go to jail? Can I afford to, you know, do I have to sit around and look at whether this ticket is going to be dismissed and go through the court process? And so we have that whole nasty kettle of fish which is coming down.
The bottom line, Robert, dealing, too, with you told me that the mayor said there's a possibility that on March 18th, the 19th, a couple of nights after St. Patrick's Day, that there is going to be another town hall meeting. I believe that our earlier caller, Roxanne, was absolutely correct, that having another major anti-war rally on March 1st, or one here, another town hall meeting here, to me, that's not going to get the job done. I want to see the listeners of this show, let us say, go on record as stating, guess what? I'm going to take the bus to work. I'm going to walk to work. I'm going to ride my bicycle to work. I'm not going to ever again buy a car, because the bottom line is that 20% of all the oil in the world is under Iraq, and this war is about oil. 28% of all the oil in California.
Jeffrey, that may be true. I don't think that's going to stop Bush from going to war.
Well, what, but 28%?
I think if everybody in Santa Cruz stopped using oil, I think Bush would still go to war.
Well, no, I'm talking, Robert, and that 28% of all oil in California is directly, it's from Iraq. And how about let's get people to stop buying automobiles? Let's get people to understand that the way that we can stop this insanity is by actually taking these kinds of steps.
Well, I got,
and stop putting money into town hall meetings and rallies.
Well, I've got no problem with, you know, I mean, I both agree with you and I disagree with you. I agree that, you know, it's not going to do it just having a big meeting, a big rally in San Francisco on March 1st. But I'll